2019 was a big year in development and housing here in Kansas City. There was a really grassroots fight for affordable housing that gained major traction, culminating in a tenants' bill of rights for Kansas City, which made national news. On the development side of things, downtown has been looking more developed than ever. Meanwhile, other communities around the metro have been trying to reinvent themselves. But 2020 is a new year, so what are the housing and development stories that we should all be following? I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about the state of housing and development in 2020 with Lisa Rodriguez. Hi, Lisa.
Morning, Gina.
Could you quickly spell out for our listeners what housing and development have to do with one another, how those two issues are linked?
I think housing and development always have gone hand in hand. And I think different cities and different places take a different approach. Sometimes it's the development, it's amenities, it's creating jobs that will bring people to an area and thus bring housing to an area. And sometimes it's the opposite. If you build housing, if you make a place to live, then eventually they'll need jobs and amenities. So it's hard to tell which come first. But they're always kind of together, and together they signify kind of the growth of an area or of a city or of a town.
So let's talk development. As you began thinking about the year ahead for development, you used a question as kind of your launching pad. And the question was, where will I see cranes in 2020?
Yeah, I think that was kind of the easiest way for us to frame this, in that development can happen all over a region, and you may not be able to see it as much, but this is something we wanted to say. Where will you be driving around Kansas City and say, whoa, things are happening here? What's happening here? And so in that sense, you know, we decided to go, you know, with where are cranes?
So when you frame it that way, what are some of the specific projects and larger trends you want to draw our attention to?
I think kind of first, you know, firstly and probably most prominently, the trend of building downtown in Kansas City, Missouri, that's going to continue and kind of kick into high gear again in 2020. There are several office towers now, you know, gotten the green light to get started. One will be a relocation of financial services company Waddell & Reed from Overland Park to downtown Kansas City, Missouri. A couple of office towers being built speculatively, which means there are no tenants. But that kind of speaks to what proponents have called, you know, a demand for really high-end office space downtown, which some people see as a really positive sign that there's interest in jobs and big firms. People are eyeing downtown Kansas City, Missouri.
And so there's a perception that there isn't that kind of office space downtown, at least not in high numbers.
Exactly. I think you would talk to people, and there is office space downtown, but not that, you know, not with the views, not with the luxuries and amenities that I think big businesses and companies want in their office space.
Sort of like national businesses.
Right.
What are the questions you're going to be asking as you watch and report this year?
I think while there is development that's going to continue to happen downtown, I think that as far as city officials and people who are consciously looking at how their city grows, where they will want to shift or incentivize development, I think at this point there's enough interest downtown that maybe that can continue to develop on its own, and city officials can focus on bringing people to other parts of the city that have not experienced that same kind of renaissance.
Are there specific parts of the city that you think are going to be getting a lot of attention in that way?
I think so. I think we can already see, at least when I talk about Kansas City, Missouri proper, I think in South Kansas City, in that Red Bridge area, has seen some growth as well. I think more of that will happen. I think city officials are also looking to bring development and jobs and retail to more economically distressed parts of the city, largely the eastern part of Kansas City, Missouri. But I think you can see development, and even, you know, I should have mentioned with cranes and stuff earlier, out in the suburbs, Johnson County is seeing an incredible amount of growth. A lot of living spaces are trying to attract younger people to the suburbs. So I think you're seeing a lot of growth there in condos, in luxury apartments.
Can you give one example of like a suburb where you see some of this happening that maybe is indicative of what's happening generally in our suburbs?
I think when you look at Overland Park, particularly downtown Overland Park at like 80th and Metcalf, that has always been this kind of cute little small downtown. I think all over there you're seeing apartment buildings go up. You've got more senior living right next to, you know, apartments that are designed to attract millennials and younger people.
This has triggered kind of an identity crisis for that community, too. Are you seeing that more broadly? This sort of like, are we the quaint little community or are we our own mini walkable downtown?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening there. I think that for a long time, you chose the suburbs. You chose to live in the suburbs because that was a lifestyle that you wanted, something that was a little bit quieter. And you would still have the option to go downtown for the amenities that are available there. And they represented kind of different things. And I think we're seeing in Overland Park, in Lenexa, north of the river, those amenities that have always that you've always had to travel for popping up in the suburbs. So there's no real reason to have to travel. And so I think for some people, that, you know, that triggers worries about suburbs becoming more isolated or more insular. But for other people, it's a really exciting thing.
You know, something I'm wondering, especially when we think about this in terms of where we will and won't see cranes in 2020, is whether you expect to see change in the historic relationship between developers and TIF in Kansas City.
I think that is a really important question and something I'll be paying really close attention to in 2020. I mean, when we say TIF, which is tax increment financing, that is just one abatement tool or incentive tool that cities use to lure companies in. You know, they sometimes come in the form of tax breaks or tax abatements,
and it's based on an assessment of blight.
Right. It's based on an assessment of blight and this idea that if an entity were not to offer those incentives or those tax breaks, then a company may not build there. I think in downtown Kansas City, Missouri, you're starting to see that's not true quite as much. And it was definitely something that the Mayor Quentin Lucas campaigned on, that a lot of the current city council people campaigned on. They said it's time to stop giving away the farm downtown and kind of shift those incentives to other parts of the city. Now, we've seen already in the last months of 2019 some major deals go through right in the heart of downtown. And so it'll certainly be something to watch. The discussions are happening now. And I do think that relationship will begin to change.
Are there interesting development stories to keep an eye on that fall outside the purview of where will I see cranes?
Yes. Yes, I think absolutely. And one example that immediately comes to mind is along Troost Avenue in Kansas City. I think it's a corridor that so often we've talked about in terms of race and being kind of a dividing line in Kansas City, but we've seen a lot of activity. There have been, you know, condos that have popped up around the 31st and Troost area, coffee shops, retail shops, restaurants around there. And I think that is going to continue in 2020. Already more lofts and living projects are going up along that corridor. And while there may not be huge cranes, I think you'll see more activity there.
With the street being perceived so often in racial terms and kind of defining how the whole city even talks about race, it's a development story, but that's also more than a development story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think where you're leading is, you know, the big gentrification word. And I think that is a major concern along Troost, is that while people are happy to see activity on a corridor that was very sleepy for a long time, at what expense is that happening? Are the people who have lived there forever now being priced out of that area? I think that you're seeing a trend that it used to be very inexpensive to buy property along Troost. And I don't think that will be the case for, you know, for too much longer. And so that's something that, you know, that city officials will have to look at, that that developers will have to think of, and the community will have to, you know, be more vocal about what they want that to be. But that's certainly something to watch.
Looking back on 2019, the fight for affordable housing and a tenants' bill of rights was, I mean, I would call it meteoric. It really doesn't feel like very long ago at all that you were sitting right here in the studio talking to me about a report that revealed to Kansas City that we even had an issue with affordable housing, because for so long the refrain had been Kansas City, affordable place to live. But from there, this whole movement was born.
Yeah, I think the release of that affordable housing report kind of woke people up to this idea that this may not be as affordable as we thought it was. But then I will attribute the, you know, the meteoric rise and this whole tenants' bill of rights movement to the arrival of one individual, of Tara Ragavir, to Kansas City. She grew up here. She had done a lot of work studying evictions in Kansas City.
For Harvard.
For Harvard. And moved back to her hometown, immediately started this this Casey Tenants group. And I think she did have some of the, you know, the conversations about affordable housing. People were interested in this at the right moment. And within a year, organized, built a really powerful group that immediately made itself a big factor in the mayoral election. They were impossible to ignore, and really pushed this Tenants' Bill of Rights through that codifies protections that exist for renters, but really puts them into a city code and establishes real protections for renters in Kansas City.
What else should we be listening for in KCUR's coverage of housing throughout the metro in 2020?
I think you'll be listening more for this conversation about how the identities of suburbs are changing. We touched on that a little bit. I think we'll continue to be covering, you know, the tension between city officials and tax incentives, and particularly the end of this economic border war between Kansas and Missouri, where the states have historically used incentives to lure companies from one side of the state line to the other.
And sometimes back and forth a few
sometimes
times.
Sometimes back and forth without really creating new jobs in the region. That will be something to watch to see if those states kind of hold up the end of their deal. But there's a lot going on when it comes to housing and development. And we'll be trying to keep tabs on all of it.
Lisa Rodriguez, thanks so much.
Thank you, Gina.
Lisa is a reporter and newscaster at KCUR. She's worked with our colleague, Laura Ziegler, on KCUR's official State of Housing and Development report, which you can read online at kcur.org. For now, we're going to let Lisa get ready for the newscast you will hear on your drive home. But our resident urban design guru here on KCUR's Central Standard will pick up where she left off in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about housing and development in Kansas City in 2020. We're going to find out about the history of how things got to be the way they are. We'll get to possible ramifications of major projects on the horizon and what's being discussed among key players in the design and planning sphere. My guest for all of that is Daniel Cerda. He's kind of a recurring guest on Central Standard. He's a city planner with LISC at the moment, but he's also a big thinker when it comes to development and transit in Kansas City. Hi, Daniel.
Good morning.
What are some of the overarching themes that caught your attention in our conversation with Lisa Rodriguez?
Well, I think there's a few things. One thing that stands out to me, especially in reading between the lines a little bit on what Lisa said about downtown development, is that downtown has reached a certain level of maturity. And so this question, for example, of whether that level of incentives are still required to make development downtown happen is that's something people couldn't have imagined even a decade ago, right? That we would get to that point where we're talking about not necessarily needing incentives to do downtown development.
Yeah.
That to me is a real bellwether in terms of the level of maturity of the idea of downtown as a very people-centric, very development-dense place. I mean, most of my life, the discussion about downtown has been about it emptying out and hollowing out and people not wanting to be there.
Yeah, what can we do to see people?
Exactly. How can we get people want to be there? We don't have a challenge with people wanting to be there.
Yeah, we see people there.
Yeah. And that's actually a huge demand driver, especially for interest in housing. downtown. But there are challenges with that. I mean, it is costly to build downtown, and whether you're using incentives or not, the rent structure is not going to be amenable to everybody. And so that's creating opportunities as well as challenges for people who are interested in urban living who can't necessarily afford to live, you know, right down in the River Market or even an adjacent neighborhood like Columbus Park.
Something we didn't discuss in the last segment is how housing and development both relate to transit, which is one of your areas of expertise.
Absolutely. So there's a couple things important here to know. There's, you know, growing evidence. This is something, you know, a lot of planners and others have known both intuitively and on the basis of empirical evidence for a long time, but it's just been really well documented in the last 2 or 3 years. There's a very strong symbiotic relationship between density and transit, but there's also a very strong relationship that's emerging between the affordability of housing and transit. There's a lot of both professional literature now as well as academic studies that show that the more that you concentrate particularly affordable housing investments on and near transit lines, the more you actually improve the efficacy of the transit operations themselves. You build ridership, and there's a symbiotic relationship there. You need the transit service, obviously, dedicated along those both fixed routes and various kinds of investments to create the interest in development. And we're just a little bit behind the curve in Kansas City, but we're actually very well positioned for that now. Kansas City Area Transportation Authority has actually created a for-profit real estate development subsidiary that's focusing on that. They issued an RFP this past fall for 3 sites. They're moving forward with a pre-development agreement and a development agreement on 2 of those sites. And so there's every expectation within the next 18 to 24 months.
And those things you described, for people who are not within the industries
sure.
you described, those are signs of actual momentum.
Those are signs of actual development impending. And basically what it boils down to in each of those cases, there's land that Kansas City Area Transportation Authority owns and controls. Right now, in both cases, 31st and Troost and 3rd and Grand, in the form of a park and ride station along a major transit route. 3rd and Grand is also immediately adjacent to the Kansas City streetcar, of course. And now there's formal development process. There's, you know, a lot of legal back and forth and negotiating of development agreements and spelling out some of the parameters for financing. But the expectation in each of those cases is there's going to be relatively large, you know, well-scaled, very transit-supportive development happening at each of those key nodes. And there's every expectation that that will not only help build ridership and reinforce the ridership that we have along those nodes, but also that it's going to create an additional level of secondary interest in development in and near those areas.
Is Kansas City's history shaping these discussions in ways that some of us might not even notice? Like, do you feel the weight of history when you think about, as we've put it, where the cranes are going and why, or who can afford housing in what part of town and why?
Absolutely. And I think in ways that aren't always as evident to people. The superficially most obvious piece of it is, as Lisa was alluding to, the potential for development east of Troost, for example, and, you know, the history of that dividing line. But there's also embedded within that this question, as she said, of where those incentives ought to be dedicated. Even further within that, there's a question of how those development incentives are actually going to be directed. One of the things that's really interesting that's going on right now, as she said, Mayor Lucas and several members of the council campaigned on wanting to change the focus of where development incentives are headed. And just in his first 3-4 months in office, Mayor Lucas has now fundamentally changed the agencies that grant those incentives through his appointments of people to those bodies who are much more circumspect about doing business the traditional way in terms of granting those incentives and being much more proactive about wanting to direct them to areas that traditionally have been underinvested.
So when we talk about Troost, I mean, it does strike me as something worth spending a minute on to just say that the development along there, when we talk about this being a historical dividing line, the development along Troost looks to a lot of people fairly white.
Sure.
I feel like that's worth discussing for a moment.
Absolutely. Well, I think there's a couple of things going on simultaneously. The first is that you have to see the development that's happening along Troost really in a broader context of what are the demand factors that are driving that. One of the key ones is the expansion of Hospital Hill. There's a whole sequence of especially public investments, as well as some supportive private investments that have happened over the last 5 years. Everything from Truman Medical Center and associated facilities being expanded, the health department building a new facility there, the school district relocating its headquarters to Troost. All of those are specifically, primarily public developments that have sort of kindled a certain level of initial development interest. And then what has happened beyond that is that, again, the incentive process has kicked in, and there are developers that are interested and see an opportunity there that are receiving incentives. Part of what's creating the racial and the social challenge of gentrification that Lisa alluded to, that you just did, is that to date, there has not been a real open, explicit conversation about how those projects ought to look in terms of affordability. And that's probably where the page is going to turn in 2020. There are hundreds of housing units that have either been constructed or have been approved and will be constructed in the next, say, 18 months or so that are going to be coming online in Kansas City. And some developers will tell you, well, they're more toward the moderate to affordable end of the range, and there are people that can afford them. But typically, you're looking at rents for studios and those apartments that are in the $700, $750 a month range to one and two bedrooms that might be as high as $1,300 to $1,500 a month. And we're talking everywhere from about 24th and Troost all the way down to Armour in Midtown. What we know, again, on the basis of housing studies and census data and other information, is that many of the people living immediately east of Troost that are part of that historical divide can't afford rents in those ranges. And so they feel very locked out of that new housing that is being built, not just, you know, by a private market that has finally awakened and become very interested in Troost Avenue, but also with very significant levels of public subsidy. So that
it also
that,
does sound like then in that case, what can superficially look like maybe like a blurring of this historical dividing line is actually maybe just a moving of it.
It can be in practice, though I think the edges of it are getting fuzzier, in part because as development moves east of Troost, it would not entirely surprise me to see this, you know, move over to Paseo and move over toward Prospect as well and see the same kind of thing. You might also see it happen, especially in the Prospect Corridor, in areas where it becomes much more of a class than a racial divide. In other words, there are apartments, you know, along Prospect where, say, the proportion of minority renters might be a little bit higher. But again, the rent structure is still similar. Again, the rent structure is going to be fundamentally a function of how those projects are financed and the investors and developers' expectations for financial return. That could shift, though, materially if there were policy changes put in place at City Hall that basically mandated affordability as a condition of receiving public incentives.
So are you concerned about the larger ramifications of any of the projects we've talked about today?
I think, again, these are all conversations. Sometimes it's when you're in midstream, as I am, many of these discussions, it's a little bit of, you know, the forest for the trees. I think there's a very, as you and Lisa both talked about, there's a very strong, very well-organized base of advocacy about affordability and equity issues in Kansas City. That being said, it is just emerging. And the real question is going to be over the next, I wouldn't say long-term horizon. I would say really short horizon, probably the next year or two. We're going to start to see whether or not that really translates into a substantial shift in how public incentives especially are directed, but also whether that's going to actually build up additional levels of interest for private support of these developments. One of the challenges, if you talk to many of the developers who are working along Troost and on the east side, that you'll hear them say is it is still very difficult to obtain private financing for those projects. In fact, I think it's very telling that many of the major developers that are building significant numbers of units, some of them are based in Kansas City, some of them are not. And whether they're based in Kansas City or not, many of them are obtaining financing, private bank financing from outside Kansas City, because many banks are still reluctant to place
local
those
banks.
Investments. Local banks are still reluctant to place investments.
It interests me that out-of-town banks don't share that reluctance.
Well, part of it is because they look at the projects, I think, you know, without the baggage, the historical baggage of thinking about whether it's east or west of Troost. They're aware of the geography of Kansas City, and they see it. I also think that there's a perhaps just generally a little less risk aversion from the types of banks that do traditionally finance what we might call more affordable housing development, particularly multifamily development in those areas. And so they're going to be a little more assertive and a little more responsive in any case. But again, it's a large challenge. It's an issue that many folks on the ground, whether it's neighborhood organizations, advocacy organizations, intermediary organizations like LISC, where I work, and others, there are a lot of conversations coming together about how to change that. There are deliberate efforts of doing much more concerted outreach and effort to get banks and others supportive and behind this development, and to do it, again, in a way where there's a little more equity in terms of, you know, affordability being an explicit component of those developments. We can't forget there's a lot of political pushback on everything that I'm talking about. Even using the word affordable sometimes raises hackles or, you know, gets people a little agitated for various reasons. What I want to make clear is that when we're talking about affordability, we're not talking about housing for people who are destitute. We're talking about housing that, you know, can accommodate people, that people can amply afford without straining their household budgets, people who are making $30,000, $40,000, $60,000, in some cases $80,000 a year in their household, but are still having challenges finding rent in good, newer, quality housing that's not going to strain their household budgets.
A range of definitions of affordability.
Not just a range of definitions of affordability, but a range of products becoming available on the market that just really are not out there right now at least in these locations.
So what is your sense of this whole question about suburban development versus urban development and how the two kind of relate to each other?
Well, it's interesting because I think there is a certain degree, maybe in some senses more symbolically, of them becoming interrelated. I think it's very telling that as downtown has resurged, we're simultaneously seeing a lot of what you might call walkable urban style development in much more suburban locations, not just in the quaint downtown of Overland Park, which is, again, in and of itself really remarkable, and there's a dramatic transformation going on there, but in really what are truly greenfield sites like Lenexa City Center. That being said, I think when you stand back and look at those, one of the things you begin to realize is that what those developments are doing is they're really speaking to a different niche in the market. Those are people who still want to be in the suburbs, who still want to be in more suburban locations, that are still drawn to the same demand factors like schools and the perception of the quality of schools in some of those suburban districts and that kind of thing, but who want to have a slightly different lifestyle. And the piece of that lifestyle issue that really stands out to me is that they're wanting a lifestyle that's less constrained by what you can do and where you can get in a car that you're driving around. People really want to be in an environment that's lively, that's social, that's interactive, but that also requires you, it enables you to have a smaller carbon footprint. And there are people very explicitly talking about that in suburban contexts. I find that to be one of the more compelling changes that's happened recently.
Daniel Serta, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate being here.
Daniel is a city planner for LISC in Kansas City, and he's our go-to guy for all things related to urban design. I'm Gina Kaufman. When Central Standard returns, we'll be hearing from people with ties to the Persian community in Kansas City. Their stories are coming up next. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And tensions continue to mount between the U.S. and Iran. For some in our community, especially people with family ties to Iran, the news that has all of our attention is deeply personal. So now we're going to hear from people in that position of watching this news story unfold, wondering how it might alter the course of their own journey. Let's start with Kansas City writer Adib Karam. Iran is his father's birthplace. Adib has never been to Iran, and every shift in geopolitics makes it either more or less likely that he will go. Adib, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You were born in the U.S. in what year?
1984.
At that time, your parents had thought they might move to Iran to raise you and your sister. That didn't happen.
Correct. That was back in the 70s, right after they had gotten married. And they actually went to Iran for a little while to meet my dad's family and then, you know, consider the possibility of moving. But after they came back, you know, the revolution ended up happening, but also my mom's parents kind of guilt tripped her about what are we going to do if you move overseas in that, you know, classic Midwestern way. And so for a number of reasons, it ended up not happening.
when you say the revolution, that is something that is known and understood to you and to a lot of our listeners, but some may be a little bit hazier on what you're referring to there.
Oh, yes. The Iranian Revolution in 1979 that saw the Shah of Iran deposed and Ayatollah Khomeini come into power and establish the Islamic Republic.
So, you know, I'm curious, having grown up here in the aftermath of all of that, what you know about the Iran your father grew up in.
Not a whole lot about, like, the geopolitics of it. I mostly know, you know, stories of just what it was like growing up there, going to school. My family is Baha'i, which is a religious minority there, and so my dad got bullied a lot growing up. And I was like, oh, me too. Like, who knew?
It was a point
for different
of relating.
Reasons. Hmm?
It was a point of relating, though,
indeed.
To your dad.
But, you know, I learned about, you know, them going on picnics in all the beautiful parks of Yazd or taking family trips to Manshad, which is a small mountain town very close by. Funny stories about, you know, just the silly things that kids do, kind of no matter where they grow up.
How does the country live in your mind, if that makes sense? Like, I know that's evolved over time, and I'd like to hear about that.
It certainly is constantly evolving. And I think part of it is always a little bit romanticized as somewhere I've never been and somewhere I would like to go. It also kind of looms as a specter of fear of, like, if I were to go, what would it be like? Would they, you know, not let me into the country? Would they let me in and not let me go?
Can you explain that for people who are not in that kind of situation and maybe have never imagined that particular predicament?
Yes, because there are no, like, formal relations between Iran and the United States. The United States government and the State Department has a go-at-your-own-risk policy where if you decide to go to Iran, they might let you in or they might not at the border, and the United States won't do anything to help you. If they do let you in and then, you know, you get in trouble for whatever reason, or if trouble is invented by the, like, state police, again, there's no American embassy to help you. There are no relations to get you out. We can look at stories like Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post reporter who was jailed for a number of years after being accused of spying.
You know,
on the other hand, like, people like Anthony Bourdain were able to go and have absolutely no problems and show
delightful meals.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, it's not like 100% of the people have 100% of trouble. It's just that if you do happen to be one of the unfortunate ones, the trouble is very bad.
Your young adult novel came out in what, 2018?
Correct.
It's called Darius the Great Is Not Okay. The main character is an awkward teenager who goes to Iran with his family to meet his grandparents, who he previously only knew through Skype. This is in some ways like fan fiction of your own life, like a what if?
I think so. It was a way of me, I think, A, exploring the feeling of being disconnected from a family. Most of my Iranian family actually lives in Vancouver, British Columbia now, and I would visit them every summer and then have to say goodbye and come back to Kansas City. And it was a way of me distilling that feeling of connection and disconnection.
And connecting and disconnecting a little more dramatically.
Yes. And it was also a really fun way of kind of taking myself on my own trip to Iran, because I got to do way more research than I had ever done. I got to click through the streets of Yazd on Google Street View. And just kind of, I guess, yeah, fan fiction of my own life. I've never thought of it that way, but I suppose
Let's put the hero here.
Right.
You know, but last time we spoke, you were torn over whether you wanted to visit Iran or not, whether you thought you would. Can you describe the two sides of that? We've gotten into it a little bit, but I'd like you to go a little bit deeper.
Yeah. I still have family in Iran, and I've gotten to meet them at, like, family reunions off-site, but I would love to go and see where my dad grew up. I'd like to go see the art, the history, go and eat the food, and go and connect with that side of my heritage. But as an American, we have a very fraught relationship. And as an Iranian American, it's even more fraught since my dad is Iranian and they do bloodright citizenship. They could consider me a citizen who has not completed my compulsory military service. Also, as a gay man, it's very kind of scary to go to Iran. And
is it still hard to be in the Baha'i minority?
I'm It is still hard. I myself am a lapsed Baha'i, and so I don't really have that to worry about as much, but certainly my family is well-known Baha'is. The ones that are still there have been harassed by the government before. My uncle has been in and out of jail. My aunt has been in jail once, I think, as well, for basically for being Baha'i. And I think there's worry, A, of trouble for me, and B, of like causing trouble for others.
With the killing of Soleimani and the fallout from that, have you felt like it's increasingly a done deal that, at least for the foreseeable future, you're not going to Iran?
I think so. I think as soon as a nuclear deal was decertified, that was pretty much squashed any hope I had. The nuclear deal happening was the first time in a long time that I felt hope about a normalizing relations between the United States and Iran, and that, oh, maybe, you know, peace is on the horizon, far away, but still on the horizon. And now, no, it's slipped
back
over
the
horizon.
Yeah. Are you experiencing a sense of personal loss over that?
It's a very weird and nebulous thing, but I think, yes, there is the loss of what might have been. That's pretty sad.
I know we are talking about a place you've never been, but it's also a place that means a lot to you, a place with a history and culture that have shaped your life, albeit from afar. What do you feel from that standpoint that you want other Kansas Cityans to maybe grasp at this political moment?
I think so often Kansas Cityans, and really we as Americans, are very self-centered. We don't recognize the shared humanity of people overseas. And part of that's just geographical. Our country is so big that it could fit like 20 others. And so, you know, we can drive for three days straight and still never see something that's not American. And we forget that there are humans everywhere, that people are going about living their lives. And that, as with here in America, often those with the least power are those who are most harmed by government decisions, both the Iranian government and the American government.
You know, I guess I hear you kind of pointing out that it's not just the news makers that are being affected here, because we hear so much about the news makers.
Right.
Decision makers.
Yeah. But, you know, the people of Iran are the ones who can't get medicine because of sanctions. You know, the government leaders, they have lots of money. They have the means. They can still get medicine. But the average everyday person those are the ones who are suffering.
Let's hear now from Roxana Shafe. Hi, Roxana.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. You know, we're going to hear your story in just a minute. But first, do you relate to what Adib just told us about this moment and how he is relating to it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think I've been over here nodding with everything that he has said, and even the effect of the people of Iran. I remember my mom stuffing vitamins into my uncle's, you know, rolled up socks in his suitcase to kind of hope that they could get things back when he would come visit in the 80s. And, you know, just trying to get things there, basic things for the people.
Your relationship with Iran is in some ways quite similar to Adib's, except that being a little bit older, you did make it to Iran for one visit before the revolution.
That's right. I was four before the revolution. And similar to Adib, we were planning to move. And the family legend is that my grandfather called. He sensed that something was happening and said, no, no, don't move here. Just come for a visit. And that was the end of our thoughts of moving.
What do you remember about your visit? Four is very young.
Well, I remember I was telling Adib in the green room, when I see the pictures, I remember a little more. I remember family. I mean, constantly family. I remember the smells. Sometimes a smell will hit me and I'll remember. I remember the streets of Tehran, and the streets of Tehran at the time had these wide gutters that between the street and the sidewalk. I don't know why. I don't know what those were, but I remember that. And the bathrooms were different. They were the bathrooms were tile, and there was no toilet. It was just different.
You remember the things that anyone would notice, but that as a kid you'd be really fixated on.
Yes. Yeah.
What brought your parents to the U.S.?
My father came in 1957. His father sent him here. My grandfather had come under the Marshall Plan and previously had sent his children to Europe to be educated. But after coming here, he sent his remaining sons only to the United States. The daughters still went to Europe. And then my mother arrived in 71 to marry my father.
Wow. Do you remember moments in the U.S.-Middle East relationship that maybe tugged at you a little differently, given your family connection to this place and culture? I am a child of the 80s myself, and the phrase Iran-Contra is emblazoned in my mind just from standing in grocery store aisles and seeing headlines.
So the Iran-Contra, I mean, I remember it being on the news, but I mostly remember the time during the hostage crisis. I remember not being able to answer the phone. That was how people would intimidate us, I guess. They would call the house. And so as a child, I was not allowed to answer the phone.
Why were people trying to intimidate you in particular, your family?
I think we were just people were frustrated about the hostage crisis, and that was...
You were visible.
And that was the 80s version of trolling. That's my biggest memory. And I do remember always having the news on during that time. The Iran-Contra affair, I guess, came as I was approaching middle school, and I was a little less interested and, you know, not paying so much attention to that. But definitely I remember the hostage crisis very well.
How do you relate to your Persian identity now as a parent?
That's really interesting. So as a parent, my Iranian identity mostly has to do with seeing other Iranians in the media, and I point them out to my children, who laugh at me. So I don't know if you ever watched Blackish.
No, but I know about it.
The oldest daughter, Yara Shahidi, is half Iranian. And so every time that show is on, I say, oh, look, she's half Iranian, just like you. And they roll their eyes and laugh at me. And then anything that happens, if someone looks a little Middle Eastern, they go, is she Iranian? Is he Iranian? Did you want to tell us about that? So that's kind of their relationship. My husband got... the book Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat
yes.
for Christmas. And as soon as he opened it, I was like, she's Iranian. And they were laughing. And they're like, of course she is. So that's our relationship. They all have Iranian names. But that's really it. Besides the food and the rugs on our floor, that like they don't really know. And they're our family. They know our family and that we're Iranian, but beyond that, I don't know how much meaning that has for them.
Even as the news shifts so dramatically to Iran.
So my oldest experiences a little anxiety, so we limit the news. And I have been on a news diet since the Muslim ban, so I don't know how much they follow the news. I did ask them when I knew I was coming here today, and my oldest said, well, it makes me sad that I can't visit now. And I reminded him...
more like what Adib is experiencing.
Yeah. But I reminded him, you weren't visiting before. Like, that's not a thing that we can do. And similar to Adib, I felt during the nuclear deal, there was some hope. And my husband and I even discussed it. And now it seems like that may never happen.
Adib and Roxana, I want to ask you both about this. You have both talked to different degrees about food. And I wonder if food is a way of connecting without political interference.
Yes, so much. The food is incredible.
Talk to me about it. You visited, so you have memories of the food, eating it there. And then I'll turn to Adib on this.
You know, I don't know that I necessarily remember the food I ate when I was four, but definitely the food plays such a big part in our family. You know, my father cooked food. I miss his cooking all the time. My husband, who's American, tries to cook chola kebab and is really amazing at it.
What is that? I haven't had
it. Oh, it's rice and kebabs. It's really a very simple dish. And then our family gets together every month. And a lot of times we try to make Persian food. And I know particularly my cousins, they will make Persian food for holidays.
Adib, we have talked about this food, and partly because in your book, Darius the Great is Not Okay, the scenes set in Iran, you bring the food to life really vividly. And I can tell that that is a tangible detail that without having visited Iran, you had some ability to experience.
Yes, certainly my family is full of excellent cooks. And so whenever I visit, I get to eat a lot of it. I think Iranians do take a lot of pride in their cuisine in general, and also as a very hospitality-focused culture. You can't visit an Iranian without being offered more food than you can eat.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what you mean by hospitality-focused culture?
Yes. In Iranian culture, there's this thing called taaruf, which is essentially a set of social cues about how people interact, and it involves, I think the closest translation I was ever given was debasing oneself to exalt others. And so, like, you go to someone's house, and they're like, would you like some food? And you have to say, no, thank you, I'm not hungry. And they'll say, no, it's really no trouble. And then you have to say, no, really, it's too much trouble, you shouldn't have, I'm not worthy, I'm the dirt beneath your feet. And it can escalate quickly from there.
But it's also like the opposite of escalation.
Yes. But really, really it is, food is the love language of most Iranians I've ever met. It's just kind of a deep-seated cultural thing that you always feed your guests.
What is your favorite thing to eat?
Ooh, I really do love cello kebab, especially because I can't really make it for myself. I live in an apartment and don't have a grill. But if I'm cooking for myself, fesenjoon, which is a stew of ground walnuts and chicken and pomegranate molasses, which is a very polarizing... People either love it or hate it, but there's very little in between.
Roxana, what do you think... do you think that the culinary experiences that you have at these family gatherings are things that your own children are likely to connect to for the remainder of their lives?
You know, I don't know. I think the family gatherings themselves will be the thing that they connect to for the rest of their lives. I think the food, you know, my kids are so American. If it's not pizza or chicken nuggets, right? Like, they think it's weird. But, you know, they do like chola kebab. They'll eat it. They love rice. So that's really good. But I think they'll take that. We're a very family focused culture in general. And I think that's what we'll carry with them.
You were laughing along with Adib as he was describing these social cues.
So I always joke that if you've seen my big fat Greek wedding, you know my family, and we were laughing about that together. And there are several lines around food in that movie, and the one is where, you know, they go to the house and they say, oh, I'm not hungry, and she says, and then she lays out this entire feast in front of them. And then the other one is, and we joke about this all the time, my cousin and I, when they say, oh, he's a vegetarian, and the aunt says, it's okay, I'll make you lamb. And because we cannot fathom not having food of any kind when someone walks through your door.
Like, the idea of restriction.
There's no restriction.
What are you wondering and waiting to see on a really personal level when you are checking in with news from Iran? I know you, Roxana, are on a news diet. But when you do check in, are there the questions that you're wondering or implications for you and your family that are top of mind?
Absolutely. And I don't know if Adib had this experience, but even when I was talking to my husband about coming here today, you know, there was a conversation about safety and what does that mean, and is, you know, weighing the importance of sharing versus could we be putting ourselves at risk? Because I do kind of remember the hostage crisis being a scary time, and the possibility and the possibility of that happening again, and definitely
of people just having a sentiment against Iranians,
yes,
in their own community.
That's true. Yeah.
Adib?
I don't know that I'm particularly looking for anything. I feel like the last 2.5 years, I guess I've mostly just kind of expected bad things to happen. I think, you know, lots of people could have guessed. And in fact, the president himself has before said, oh, if you don't like the news cycle, start a war with Iran. You know, he said that President Obama would start a war with Iran to win a re-election. And now we see, you know, the orange one doing that very same thing to avoid an impeachment trial. And I think anymore, I'm just looking to see, you know, what's next.
Roxana Shafei, Adib Karam, thank you both so much for being here today and sharing your stories.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Roxana and Adib are both people with ties to Iran through family. And Adib is a celebrated author of young adult fiction. His last book is Darius the Great Is Not Okay. A sequel will be published in August. We will definitely have him back then. Our time is up, but you can grab either of this morning's conversations online at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. It's also where you can find Friday's conversation about the best brunches in town, in case you were snowed in over the weekend and want to try again. Of course, if you're a superstitious Chiefs fan, you will probably want to repeat whatever you did yesterday to help the team get to the Super Bowl. So that's your call what to do next weekend. Our official brunch list is at kcur.org. Do what you want with it. Tune in tomorrow to hear about the work of sopranos, as in women who sing really, really high notes and not a fictional television family. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.